just how broken is our healthcare system? Stephen Brill joins us to talk about his latest book, America's Bitter Pill.
The single most frequent, obvious consumer communication we get is an insurance company's explanation of benefits. The CEO of the largest, most successful insurance company in America can't explain it. Why would anyone expect that any of the rest of us can figure it out?
What does it mean to blur the line between autobiography and fiction? Heidi Julewicz will tell us about her review of Rachel Cusk's new novel, Outline.
It would both feel like the most incredible compliment to come under her gaze, or you feel like you would learn something about yourself that no one else could tell you because this person, it's almost like talking to a psychic, you know?
Alexander Alter will be here with notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Stephen Brill joins me now. He is the author of America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Pamela.
This book grew out of a story you did for Time magazine. When did that story come out? What were the origins of that article?
That was about 2 years ago. And the origin of that was very simply, I was curious about why healthcare in this country costs so much. During all the debates over Obamacare, the real political debate was, well, who should pay in this country for the very high cost of healthcare? And I kept thinking to myself, well, wait a minute, why is the cost so high? Why do we spend almost twice as much per capita as most of the other developed countries in the world on healthcare, and our results aren't as good or maybe as good, but they're certainly no better? And I just decided to follow the money and just look at healthcare bills. And that caused quite a storm when it became a special issue in Time magazine. And then as the Obamacare legislation was passed and began to be implemented, I decided that the best way to tell the much broader saga of healthcare in the United States and of how a dysfunctional healthcare system is not going to be fixed by a dysfunctional Washington was to track what happened with Obamacare and whether it's going to fix anything, and if not, why not.
And you wrote a few follow-up stories for
right.
Time. Did you know from the very get-go that it was going to turn into a book, or at what point did you decide?
No. It's actually funny. I originally thought that what I was going to do was a follow-up story for Time dramatizing the triumphant launch of Obamacare. Which gives you some sense of how naive I was. So I began to report that story during the summer of 2013. The exchanges, the Obamacare exchanges, were supposed to launch October 1, 2013. During one of my first reporting trips down to Washington, almost as an afterthought, I asked people in the White House and at the Department of Health and Human Services, whom I was interviewing, who's in charge of the launch? And they'd give me an answer. I'd put it in my notebook. And as I got back on the train and I looked at my notebook, I realized I had asked that question to seven different people in the White House and in the Department of Health and Human Services, and I'd gotten seven different answers. And I got home that night and I said to my wife, you know, I don't think this story is going to work. I don't think this thing's going to launch the way everybody says it is.
Did you talk to those seven people?
Oh, yeah.
And did each of them think that they were in charge?
They each thought they were in charge, and I could show you magazine articles or newspaper articles in this newspaper and others that said they were in charge.
Another kind of surprise that happened along the way is that you had a healthcare crisis.
Yeah,
I
would categorize that as something of a surprise, yes. Literally on the last day of enrollment in the Obamacare exchanges, March the 31st, 2014, I had gotten a routine checkup from my very careful doctor. And he took my pulse on one wrist and then on another wrist and said, something a little strange here. Go get this test and go get that test. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm writing all this stuff about medical bills and testing and overtesting. You know, I hope this guy isn't doing that. Long story short, I was told on March 31st that I had something called an aortic aneurysm, which is a bubble on your heart. Now, I had no symptoms. I had worked out that day. I work out every day. I literally have never had a sick day from work. And he said, you need open heart surgery. And I said, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. I feel fine. And he said, well, you will feel fine until you don't. This thing, in any given year, the size of your bubble is such that in any given year, there's a 17% chance that it will burst. And when it bursts, you don't even get to the emergency room. You just die. So 3 days later, I was in the hospital. And as I explained in the opening chapter of the book, you know, when you're working on something and working on something and working on something, you tend to dream about it at night. At least I do. So I'm in this hospital bed and I wake up and I see that I'm in a hospital, but I think I'm dreaming because I, you know, I'm saying to myself, boy, you really have gotten into this whole healthcare thing, you know, pretty heavy. And then I would sort of pinch myself and say, no, you're actually in the hospital. You're, you know, you're having your chest sawed open tomorrow morning and you're having open heart surgery. And that sort of brought it all home to me in the sense that it's one thing to know intellectually that healthcare is a different kind of product for people, that when people buy healthcare, they're not really thinking about the cost, they don't have any knowledge, and they're afraid. It's one thing to know that intellectually, it's quite another thing to feel that and see that from, you know, lying in a hospital bed.
It did cause you, though, to kind of think about things like MRIs. So MRIs, yeah. Talk a little bit about MRIs. You have a startling statistic in the book about how many MRIs.
Well, we, as a general matter, we overtest, we overuse high-tech equipment. The reason hospitals do it is it's so profitable. And I think we have something like 6 times the number of MRI pieces of equipment per capita, per people in the United States, as they do in England or France. And we charge 2 or 3 times the amount for each test. And those are hugely profitable businesses. Now, the hospitals will say that they're also, you know, great pieces of equipment, great pieces of technology. And I now am the last person to say that they're not, because what an MRI did was it presented this perfect video picture of this bubble on my heart that my surgeon was able to use as the guide or the blueprint for doing the surgery that he had to do. So that's the dilemma. I mean, the stuff works, but it's overused and it's hugely expensive.
When people look at the huge mess of healthcare in America, you know, there's a desire to find sort of the one bad guy. Is it the insurers? Is it the hospitals? Is it the big pharma? Is it the medical technology companies? Is it doctors? Are they somehow implicated in all this? Did you come down with one answer for us, or is it a combination? How does that work?
Well, we can do sort of a process of elimination. First, it's not the doctors. You know, unless they're operating a clinic or they're consulting, you know, for drug companies and then prescribing the drugs that they're consulting for, which some do, unless they're doing that, they're not riding the gravy train that I discovered when I did this reporting. And it's certainly not the nurses. What it is all the other people who are in the business of healthcare, whether they're hospital administrators or drug company CEOs or medical device makers. And they're the ones who, in this country, unlike every other country, are making exorbitant profits. Now, drug companies and medical device makers make very high profits in other countries. It's not like they're doing it for free. But here, it's like a gold rush. It just continues to be, and we pay the price. The insurance companies really aren't the bad guys. They're just sort of hapless and hopeless. They're the ones, if you step back and think about it, who are sort of on our side of the equation. They pay high medical bills just the way we do. In fact, if we have insurance and you know, the coinsurance is such that, you know, we pay 20% of a bill and they pay 80%, that means they're paying 80% of a high price and we're paying the 20%. What I found in doing the reporting is that, yes, they're incompetent. Yes, they're mean to their customers because they're sort of backed into a corner because, you know, they're so beset by the high prices that they're forced to pay, and they're so beset by the highly concentrated hospitals and hospital systems that have so much market power over them. But they're not really the bad guys. There's a scene in the book where I get to do what I'll bet you half the people listening to this would love to do, which is after I get out of the hospital, I get 36 different explanations of benefits in 36 different first-class envelopes from UnitedHealthcare, which mm-hmm. is my insurance company. Now, the fact that they came in 36 different envelopes tells you something about the efficiency of the system right there. So I'm opening them up with my wife. We both like to think of ourselves as fairly intelligent people. We have law degrees. And the second or third one I open up says, amount billed Zero. Amount paid by insurance company, zero. Amount you owe, $154.
Look at this thing. Equation.
Yeah, we look at this thing. We're going through all the codes, you know, that are on the back of this thing to see if we can decide. We cannot figure it out. So as it happened, before I'd had the operation, I had scheduled an interview with the CEO of UnitedHealthcare to talk about Obamacare and the ramifications for the industry. So I went out to do that interview following the surgery, you know, once I was able to travel. I walked him through what's going to happen to the health insurance industry, what's, you know, in the wake of Obamacare, all that stuff. And then at the very end, I reached into my suit jacket pocket and I pulled out that explanation of benefits. And I said, you know, I wonder if you could do me a favor while I'm here. And I hand him that explanation of benefits with the amount billed zero, the amount I owe, $154. Do you think you could just explain this to me? And he looks at it. He looks at it. He's got, you know, his PR guy sitting next to him is getting like more nervous
right.
by the second,
visibly
you know,
sweating.
As this is going on. And he finally looks up and says, I could sit here all day and I couldn't decode that for you. I don't know why they sent that to you. And I said, well, aren't you they? It's your bill. You're
right.
the CEO of the company. And what that tells you in a nutshell is what our healthcare system is. The single most frequent, obvious consumer communication we get as patients in the American healthcare system is an insurance company's explanation of benefits. The CEO of the largest, most successful insurance company in America can't explain it. Why would anyone expect that any of the rest of us can figure it out?
Did Obamacare address any of this?
The good news about Obamacare is it provided health insurance coverage with taxpayer-paid subsidies to tens of millions of Americans, and that helped erase a national disgrace, which is that we're the only country in the free world that doesn't provide health care to all of our citizens, by and large. That's the good news. The bad news is the prices are still too high. It did nothing to address the core issue of prices. It addressed the coverage side of the equation, but not the price side. What Obamacare really did was create tens of millions of new customers paying through our taxpayer dollars, because they all have, or almost all of them have a subsidy to buy their insurance, paying with our taxpayer dollars the same ridiculous price. If you look at the bottom line of Obamacare, it's yes on coverage, but it did nothing to address costs. And by the way, the lesson for how Washington works there is that that's the kind of reform that can be passed in Washington. It's, quote, reform, unquote, that does nothing to harm the special interests who do all the lobbying if you have a bill like this. The pharmaceutical industry backed Obamacare because guess what? It created all these new customers who are going to buy these drugs at the same high prices. The medical device industry didn't oppose it. The hospitals backed it because they get all these new paying customers.
I think sometimes that a whole generation of Americans was sort of falsely, they were misled by this Schoolhouse Rock video, I'm Just a Bill, that showed how a bill goes through Congress.
Right.
happens a lot more neatly in the song. But, I mean, this is, it's such a huge issue to try to cover in a book. Did you sort of think of it as a narrative of this is how this one bill gets passed and sort of the immediate aftermath? Like, how did you
I didn't want to frame really it. Frame it that way, and it's not quite framed that way because that would be kind of boring. I used the narrative arc of the fact that this healthcare reform bill was passed as a way of talking about how the healthcare system works and doesn't work, how Washington works and doesn't work, and how it's even more broken down than it is before because any sense of bipartisanship is gone. I mean, what people really need to understand about Obamacare and, you know, the reason that all the special interests liked it is Obamacare is a slightly more conservative version of a proposal Richard Nixon made in the 1970s. And it's a much more conservative version of what Governor Romney did in Massachusetts. So, you know, the Democrats who always wanted health care reform, always wanted, you know, the single payer system, as it's called, they finally relented. And much to their shock, when they relented and agreed to back a, you know, the Republican version of health care reform, the Republicans turned on them. You know, the charge, the rhetoric that the Republicans used was this is a government takeover of health care. Well, it's exactly the opposite. It's the government, the taxpayers, paying the private sector to get all these new customers in the private sector. It's not a government takeover.
When you look at Obamacare, does it come down to good bill, but doesn't go far enough, hasn't been implemented as well as it could have been?
Well, it certainly hasn't been implemented as well as it could have been. And that's not only the saga of the website, which I go through in some dramatic detail,
right.
the crash and then the rescue, but also a lot of the little stuff. There are regs that took years to be written that could have stopped the kind of abusive billing by hospitals, could have stopped hospitals from suing people into bankruptcy. They could have written those regs the day the bill was signed in 2010, and they just didn't do it. That's a combination of lobbying, getting to the Democrats, and incompetence. One of the things that I think is lost in Washington is the notion or the understanding that competent government is actually really important. The train wreck that was the website launch on October 1, 2013 was a train wreck that lots of people saw coming beginning in 2010 because the Obama administration just did not pay attention to governing. There's a scene in the book where literally the night the bill is passed in Congress, Obama has a celebration on the Truman balcony. And as it turns out, there's a staff person who kept a daily journal.
Mm-hmm.
And this person wrote in this person's journal that night, quote, seems to be an assumption that passage equals implementation, very troubling. And what the person meant was that everybody in the Obama administration, starting with the president, was immediately focused on how can we get people to sign up on these exchanges and not focused on, well, if they go to sign up, will they be able to sign
right.
up? Will the damn thing
actual
work?
Mechanics.
Yeah.
Reporting a story like this is incredibly difficult, obviously, because of all these players. You had
right.
the opportunity to interview Obama, but it had to be done in writing.
Right.
What was that like and how did
well,
how
it was
work?
It was a real dance, a real negotiation. First, they said they were going to do it one-on-one. And their excuse was, well, he wants to have a chance to be, thoughtful with his answers. I said, yeah, well, what he wants to have a chance to do is to run it by, nine people on the communications
right.
team before he puts an answer back. So what I want is your assurance that he's seen and read and personally signed off on all these answers. And they gave me that assurance. And I'm going to put the questions to him and I'm going to publish the entire Q&A in the back of the book so that if he doesn't answer a question, people will know that he read the question because you've just told me he's going to read all the questions and he decided not to answer it. And tellingly, one of the few questions he decided not to answer was a question I said that I felt compelled to ask him because in all my reporting, so many of his senior aides said that Valerie Jarrett was the real chief of staff and that Valerie Jarrett was the reason that the website didn't launch the right way because she kept blocking the people who wanted to provide that information to the president from telling him the bad news that this thing is screwed up and you need to put someone in charge. And he didn't answer that question.
Hmm.
There were lots of people, like, for example, the budget director, Peter Orszag, Larry Summers, who was the head of the Economic Council, and lots of other people who kept telling the president, this is not going to work. You need to bring someone in from the outside to implement this. And again, Jarrett kept, pushing back on them. But even after the law happened, and those same people, by the way, were telling the president, we need to do more to control costs. There's nothing in here to control costs. There were bitter fights in the White House about that. Once the law happened, even when these people are out of government, they're still, on the record, loyal to the president.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an admirable thing. You work for a boss, you're loyal to the boss. But I didn't come across anyone who was, in this context, loyal to the country,
mm-hmm.
who, was willing to speak up, 6 months before the launch of the website and say, I'm leaving the government because this thing is a catastrophe waiting to happen. It's going to undermine everything we've worked for. All the reforms we've worked for are going to look terrible and are going to be in political trouble the first week in October. Because the website's going to crash. Those people don't seem to exist anymore in this country.
with a book like this, whether you want to or not, it's kind of the natural thing to come up with some kind of prescription, some kind of solution in bringing it all to a close. Did you have that?
Yeah, I did at the end, and it actually was generated in part by the surgery I had, which produced two things. First of all, a real good perspective on a quality healthcare system, in this case, the New York Presbyterian healthcare system, the hospital and all the doctors. And second, the time I had, you know, the 3 or 4 weeks, you know, after when I really, you know, could do nothing other than try to think about this. What I decided was the way to fix this, in addition to very tight regulation of drug prices and medical device prices, is to allow the now ever expanding, you know, major healthcare systems in the country, whether it's the Cleveland Clinic or New York Presbyterian or, you know, Long Island Jewish or Yale New Haven, let them expand, but put tight controls on them. And as they expand, as they take over all the doctors' practices that they're taking over and all the clinics that they're taking over, let them sell health insurance. Why should I buy health insurance from United Healthcare hoping that New York Presbyterians in my network and hoping that my doctors in my network, if I bought insurance directly from New York Presbyterian,
right,
I'd know exactly what the brand is. I'd know exactly who's in my network. It would cut out the middleman, and it would also remove the perverse incentive in the system. Right now, hospitals and doctors are incented to charge for each thing they do. So the hospital makes more money if they order more tests.
Right.
The doctor makes more money if he or she orders more tests or sees you more often. If the hospital and the doctor are, in fact, part of the entity that is the insurance company, and the insurance company is no longer paying for each test, but the insurance company is just managing the healthcare, that incentive goes away. So in other words, if I paid New York Presbyterian $8,000 a year and the deal was, here's $8,000, no matter what happens to me, you keep me well. I think that's better than paying, you know, United Healthcare $8,000 and saying, if I get sick, I hope that my doctor's in your network. I hope you don't deny me care. I hope you send me an explanation of benefits that I can understand, which is not going to happen. And I'm hoping for the best. This would create a real consumer brand. And then in New York, you could have, you know, New York Presbyterian competing with Mount Sinai, competing with the other, you know, big hospital systems in New York, for my business based on the quality of their hospitals, the quality of their doctors, and on what they're going to charge me. That would cut costs, but that can only happen in an environment where those monopolies, or if there's more than one, the oligopolies, are tightly regulated. Their profits should be regulated. They need ombudsmen to make sure they don't have an incentive to deny me service. But I think that may be the only solution we have left.
All right. An interesting proposal, sure to be controversial. Stephen Brill, thank you so much for being here. The book again is America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System, reviewed this week on the cover by Zephyr Teachout. Alexander Alter is here with news from the publishing world. What's going on?
So this year, I was just looking at a lot of the novels that are coming out this spring, and there's another cluster of really great-looking literary fiction from veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars. We've already seen some incredible literature coming out of those wars with Phil Klein's Redeployment. He won the National Book Award, and with Kevin Power's Yellow Birds. And now there's four more books coming this spring from different publishers, and they all have kind of a fresh or a sort of unique take on those conflicts, and they're written by veterans.
Michiko Kakutani had an A1 story just a week or two ago about this sort of recent spate of war literature.
Yeah, she had a very thorough look at some of the great fiction and nonfiction that's been coming out of those conflicts, and sort of the gestation period and why we're seeing it, you know, coming now, sort of years afterwards. Some of the books that are coming up are kind of interesting. One is The War of the Encyclopedists. It's coming out in May from Scribner. And what struck me about that is it's co-authored by a veteran and a poet. Their names are Christopher Robinson and Gavin Kovite. And that's kind of a coming-of-age story a little bit. It's about these two friends who are in their 20s, and it's after college, and one of them is in the National Guard and gets deployed to Baghdad. So it's sort of about how their lives diverge. In next month, in February, there's two books coming out. One is Green on Blue. It's a novel by Elliot Ackerman. He's a decorated veteran of the Iraq and Afghan wars and a White House fellow. And what struck me as interesting about this book is he wrote from Afghans' perspectives. He wrote about a young orphan and his older brother and sort of how their village was affected when it was occupied or when U.S. forces came in, and they sort of get sucked into the conflict. So that's sort of interesting to write from the other perspective, right?
Risky move, yeah.
Yeah, risky move. And so, you know, Khalid Hosseini blurbed it already and called it harrowing and absorbing. So it seems like he pulled it off. Another one coming out in February is The Knife by Ross Richel, and that's coming from Blue Rider Press. And this is kind of, it sounds a little bit more like an adventure story. It's about a special operations unit, and he, the author himself, was a special operations part of a command direct action team. So, but anyway, the publisher is describing it as Redeployment, which is Phil Clay's short story collection, meets No Easy Day.
And number four?
Number four is The Valley by John Renahan. He served in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division as a field artillery officer. So everyone is sort of coming from different positions in the Army and different perspectives. And he served in Iraq. And his book is coming out this March from Dutton. And it's set in the mountains of Afghanistan. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how well these books do commercially, how they do critically, you know, whether this is a whole new generation of writers. There are now these, you know, veterans writing workshops that Phil Klei is a graduate of. So there are people who are seeking out veterans and trying to get their stories down. And there's a real community, it seems like, building within the literary world.
And perhaps a need on their end to get these stories out.
Absolutely. As you remember from, you know, Phil Klei's acceptance speech at the National Book Awards, he was saying, you know, he couldn't process his experiences on his own. This was like a need of his to sort of communicate what he had gone through. So
yet another reason why we need stories and books.
Exactly.
Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Heidi Julewitz is here to talk about her review this week of Rachel Cusk's new novel, Outline. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Pamela.
So you liked this book.
I loved this book. One thing I will say that's interesting is that it says, you know, of course, I read the back copy before I read the book, and it says it's a novel in 10 conversations. What that implied to me was that this was going to be a very talky novel. What I found is that the novel is very quiet. And I think I write about this in the review, how it feels as though you're just almost underwater with this character. There's a real intimacy that feels, like you're inside somebody's head looking out at the world with them.
And who's the narrator?
The narrator is a woman who, in very faintly sketched details, resembles Rachel Cusk herself. She is a novelist. She lives in England. She has a few kids. She is divorced. And she's in Greece to teach a writing workshop.
It's almost impossible to talk about a Rachel Cusk novel, especially one like this that's so largely autobiographical, without just giving a bit of background about Rachel Cusk. In the UK, she's just she's a known entity. She's like, you know, it's like saying Lena Dunham here. Like, everyone has some kind of opinion. But for those who are not familiar with Rachel Cusk, who is Rachel Cusk?
Probably the reason that she has that reputation in part is because of a couple of memoirs that she wrote. One, which was about her life after she had her children and what that period of time was like for her. I think she got attacked. It was actually kind of fun while I was reviewing this book to go back and revisit some of the attacks.
This was a life's work.
A life's work that she received. And it's just really interesting. People were like, you shouldn't even have had children. If you're that miserable, why did you even have kids? She really strikes a nerve.
She talked about sort of the ambivalence of motherhood.
She talked about the ambivalence of motherhood. And to be honest, you know, I read that memoir of hers 5 days before I gave birth to my first kid.
Welcome to...
Yeah. And I have to say, how do you say this? I hate Reddit, you know? I was reading it and feeling like this was news I wasn't really happy to receive at that moment in my life. I was on this precipice of becoming the person that she was just like, hey, here's what's awaiting you. And I feel like I made all of these vows, like, well, that's not going to happen to me. I will never take backstage. You know, there's a great scene, whatever. She describes being in a dress store. I remember in that memoir very much, this is what sticks out for me the most. She's in a dress store and she sees this girl maybe trying on a wedding dress or trying on some kind of dress. And maybe she's pregnant. The woman is still feeling like, oh, the world's about me. And Rachel Cusk is kind of in the background saying, you know, it's not going to be about you for much longer.
Right.
Once you have a child, you're going to be backstage.
It's all over.
Yes, exactly.
But that work, nonetheless, even though it was attacked, was sort of it was also hugely embraced. But then
hugely
her next
embraced.
Memoir
yes.
was more.
Yes. And this one was about her husband. Well, it's about her divorce.
Aftermath.
She talks about some pretty controversial things. It's what's fantastic about her, I think, is that she doesn't shy away from saying stuff that maybe other people who are having some kind of similar feeling, but, you know, for very good reason, don't want to articulate it. It won't be very popularly met. She talks about, I think, not the failure of feminism necessarily, but her husband essentially quit his job and started to raise their children and take care of their domestic life. And she continued to work and she found herself starting to lose respect for him, falling into this trap of, oh, you're not the man, you're not the money earner. And then just sort of questioning the ideals that we have for gender relations, how feminists have daydreamed, I guess, about the future of domestic relations. And she was kind of living in it and it wasn't really working for
right.
her.
Even the fantasies are all wrong.
Yeah.
She was called, I think in the UK, the first literary bad mother.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's something to be proud of. I know.
Is there an American equivalent?
I don't know. I mean, Ayelet Waldman had a book called Bad Mother.
Maybe
that makes her the bad mother. Yeah. I mean, in a weird way, it has become a little bit bragging rights, kind of, don't you think?
Right.
And it's sort of what's interesting to me about this novel is how it, maybe not in reaction to the responses she got in earlier books, but what is so astonishing to me about this book is how it just withdraws into itself. And so you don't necessarily feel like this is a mother, this is a woman, this is a man. It's like her identity is being constructed from so deeply within her body that you're not allowed to make the same kind of judgments. She can say things with a bit more freedom.
We know her, again, to the extent that we do in this country, as a memoirist because of Aftermath, because of A Life's Work. But this is actually, I think, her fifth or sixth novel.
Yes.
One of the things that reviewers have been noting, and I don't know if you saw the same thing, is that it's very different from her earlier novels.
It does feel like a break. It feels like a really exciting break. It feels like a break not just for her as a novelist, but just for novelists generally. I feel when I read this book, I felt the same way that I felt when I read Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. I read it and just thought, oh my God, so many people are going to want to write books like this. It feels very liberating to read this book. And I think what it does is it points toward maybe a cultural shift in our definition of realism, right? And what Cusk wrote prior to this, I would say, falls more into the category of traditional realism as we understand it. Characters and flashbacks and narrators and plots, right? Maybe we are starting to feel that that has maybe more artifice to it than it does any connection to what feels real anymore. And I don't know. I feel like she's tapping into this maybe cultural desire to break out of that.
How does she handle plot in Outline?
She meets people. and I think that's also what's great about this novel is that it's about connections between two human beings in actual space and time.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, too, that's partially what appeals to me about it is that it's about a human going out into the world and encountering other humans. And
those are the 10 conversations?
Yeah. And so some of them are friends that she meets. You know, the setup is essentially she flies to Greece. And on the plane, she meets a guy. They talk. Then the next chapter is she meets another guy in Greece who is actually a friend of hers. And they go for a walk. And then in subsequent chapters, she just The man from the plane, she reconnects with him. He has a boat. They go out on his boat a number of times. He eventually actually tries to kiss the narrator, and this is actually the only time in the novel where she says, I'm scared. And it's almost like suddenly somebody is like, no, you have a body. Like, he tries to interact with her body. He touches her, and this is this, it feels like this incredible violation. Even as a reader, you feel the violation because she really just hasn't had a body at all. And now someone's trying to kiss it. It's like you're pressing your face up against a glass window. Suddenly you're like, whoa, there's a window there, you know?
It's funny because everyone I know who's read this book has wanted to talk about it. It's like, this is a book that people want to have a conversation about, that there's something to be discussed.
Yeah, well, I do think it's about connection. It really is about this. I was thinking about this morning, apropos of really nothing. I sent away to this company to get paint chips for my dinghy. I want to repaint my dinghy. And the guy sent me the paint chips, and then he hand wrote me this note, like, dear Heidi, here are the colors. If you want other colors, whatever. It was just this really sweet handwritten note. Mm-hmm. And I am so touched by it. I'm still so touched by it. I think that maybe because we have redefined connection, that it happens online, it happens without faces, it happens without handwriting, it happens without these sort of personal touches, that when it does happen, it feels really cathartic. I don't know. It feels like it taps into something really kind of emotional to me. And this book is about somebody going out and really connecting with people, really striving to make a connection, not just to hear their stories, but then to kind of synthesize their story with her story to create a kind of portrait of them both.
In your review, you said, spend much time with this novel and you'll become convinced she is one of the smartest writers alive.
Yeah.
How does that come through?
Oh, my God. Just the observations she makes about people, they're just stunning. They're stunning. They are so sharp. And maybe this is also why this book feels like a departure, is that there's all of the sharpness, but it doesn't feel it feels like there's a generosity in the sharpness, if that makes sense. It's like she's seeing, the narrator is seeing so deeply into these people, but it's not in order to expose them. It's in order to understand them.
The Guardian called it one of the oddest, most breathtakingly original and unsettling novels I've read in a long time. That was the reviewer for The Guardian. And what is it that's so original? Is it the structure? Is it that blurring of the line between?
Maybe it's the blurring of the line. Maybe it's the fact that you are assembling a portrait of a person while looking at other people. Mm-hmm. So it's happening almost in your peripheral vision. You're not aware that it's happening. And I think maybe what's unsettling about it is, again, what I was saying about the sharpness of the observations. I don't know. When I was turning the pages, I just suddenly would have these moments of like, oh, she can see me, you know, like
right.
The narrator can see me. It would both feel like the most incredible compliment to come under her gaze, or you feel like you would learn something about yourself that no one else could tell you because this person, it's almost like talking to a psychic, you know?
You know, it's funny. I don't know. It's a bit of a generalization, but it seems that there have been a number of books in recent years, I think almost exclusively, if not entirely, by women that have had this like very intimate, they're slender novels, almost often episodic in nature. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Jenny Ophel's mm-hmm, Department mm-hmm. of Speculation. I don't know. I wonder if there's something going on with this.
I know. It's interesting. This does feel very different from Jenny's novel in that one really did feel like it was about a particular person and you felt like you were in her head, but you felt more like you were outside looking and learning about her.
Mm-hmm.
And this feels like the view is outward. It feels
like
more,
you're the narrator.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really the sensation is, okay, you know those things that when you're at overlooks or scenic overlooks and they're the big, huge binoculars, what are those things called that you put your eyes in, you put in a quarter and you can see mm-hmm. great distances?
We don't know what those things are called.
What are those called? Okay, anyways, those things. But you know how when you look through, it's actually very creepy. If you look down or you look to the side, it's just like black space.
Right.
Right? But if you look straight ahead, you can see very clearly the world up close. That's what reading this book is like. That's where you are, right? So you're kind of in somebody's head. So if you look to the side or you look down, you can kind of feel the vastness of this other consciousness around you. it's really, I don't know, I'm making it sound like you need to be taking mushrooms to read this book.
Well, it sounds like you need to read the book. the book, again, is Outline by Rachel Cusk. Heidi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela.
Heidi Julewitz reviews this week in the book review Rachel Cusk's latest novel, Outline. Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
There actually is bestseller news this week. We do have new titles on both the fiction and nonfiction list. Quite a lot on the hardcover fiction list, actually. There are 5 new titles. You may remember from Dwight Garner's review of the excellent Rachel Cusk novel Outline, which Heidi Julewitz discussed earlier on this podcast. He said that it was kind of the perfect book for post-holidays. Judging from the hardcover fiction list, the perfect book for the post-holidays is a shoot 'em up action adventure. 4 of the 5 new titles are just your basic thrillers. The only exception is new at number 16. That book is The Rosie Effect by Graham Simsion, which is a follow-up, a sequel to his debut novel, The Rosie Project, about a genetics professor who has Asperger's syndrome.
That was a big global hit, I think, before it came
well,
over
well,
here.
Graham Simsion is Australian, and that book was a mega hit in Australia. Kind of a romantic comedy about an Asperger's patient and a professor who doesn't realize that he has Asperger's and gradually falls in love with a colorful, eccentric woman.
So one Aspie lit, 4 thrillers on the, new on the list.
That's the ratio. The 4 thrillers start down at number 11. Brad Taylor continues his Pike Logan series with a book called No Fortunate Son, about a shadowy and far-reaching terrorist organization. Then at number 9, Jack Higgins continues his Sean Dillon series with a book called Rain on the Dead. That one is about a shadowy and far-reaching terrorist organization. Then at number 7, W.E.B. Griffin and his son, William E. Butterworth IV, have a book called The Assassination Option. That also continues a series. They have started a series that's kind of historical thrillers, looking back at the early days of the CIA. That one, again, is called The Assassination Option. And finally, Tess Gerritsen, who writes the Rizzoli and Isles series, which has been now turned into a TV series as well, has the latest book in that series called Die Again. That's new at number 5. Over on the nonfiction list, there's just one new title. At number 9, it's called Don't Give Up, Don't Give In. And the author is Louis Zamperini, written with David Renson. Zamperini, I'm sure most of our listeners and readers will recognize, is, of course, the subject of Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken. This is sort of a memoir, sort of an inspirational book of advice. Zamperini died last July, and this is the 2nd memoir he wrote. He had written one prior to Hillenbrand's book that is the book that caught her attention. And then in the wake of Unbroken's success, he decided to write another. And this is kind of his advice for people about how he persevered through all of the hardships in his life.
Did he finish it before he died, or did his co-writer?
He finished it just before he died. Literally, he and Renson sent the book to the publisher, and Zamperini died 2 days later on July 2nd.
My work is done.
Yeah.
I hear that he died shortly right after he saw first cut of the film as well.
So is that right?
Yeah, wow. It's really tied up all the loose ends. All right, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.